back to another episode of I Know, a Solo Beatles video cast where we talk all things Solo Beatles. Now today, we have the only member of Crown Royalty on the that I've had on. You may know her for her book, which we are discussing today, The Songs We Were Singing Guided Tours to the Beatles' Lesser Known Tracks, and Michael Jackson FAQ, All That's Left to Know About the King of Pop, and Phantom and the Beatles, the act you've known for all these years, co-authored with one of my favorite people, Kem Womack, one of my favorite Beatles authors. And she's also the co-host of the best solo Beatles video cast, Talk More Talk. A solo Beatles video cast along with Ken Womack sometimes, Ken Michaels, Joe Mayo, and Tom Hunyadi. Welcome back, Kit.
Oh, thank you, Hudson. It's always a pleasure to be back on your show and at the other solo Beatles video cast. The other great one.
Thank you. And you recently did a Do you want to tell us a little bit about the show that you did last night?
Absolutely. We did a great show, and we had a guest, Al Sussman, who's a good friend of both of ours, longtime fixture in Beatle fan community. He's the executive editor of Beatle Fan. We did a show. We do this periodically, this series called Another Listen, where we take an album that was, at the time of its release, commercially and critically may have been, trashed or at least did not sell well and is kind of still controversial in the fan community. And we give it another listen and decide, did it deserve the initial reception it got? And so last night we did the episode, the latest installment of this, on Ringo's Bad Boy album from 1978. And we had a lot of fun and had a good discussion. We had a good, vigorous discussion on it. And the audience really got into it, too. And the episode, it's up on our Facebook page, but I will be posting the episode up on our YouTube channel, and it will be up on virtually any podcasting platform you can think of very soon. So you'll be able to weigh in on what you think too. But we had a lot of fun. We always do. We always have a lot of fun doing another listens because, there are some people that are firmly defend the album. There are others who say, nah, they got it right the first time. And we love doing another listens.
Yeah, it's probably my favorite series that you guys do.
And we'll be doing plenty more.
Good. And you kept the Bad Boys in line.
Yes, I did. The Bad Boy Oyoyoys. Absolutely.
Yes. I mean, if I was Ken's temporary replacement, he would have failed.
Yes. Ken Michaels couldn't join us last night, but want to send our best wishes out to him. His wife is recovering from surgery, recovering extremely well, thank goodness. So he was not able to join us last night. He is going to be back for the next episode, and he will be able to give his rebuttal. In fact, we heard from him right after the show last night.
I bet you got a long angry messages.
And he said, I want time to give my rebuttal in the next episode. We're like, fine, Ken. We will. You will. Absolutely.
I can guess that letter, that message was really long.
No. And he said he enjoyed it. He said he enjoyed the episode, but he said, I want time to give my rebuttal. We're like, fine. No problem. But it was a lot of fun. So look for that. That will be up on, YouTube and all the podcasting platforms this week. So look out for that.
So going into the book, first of all, I want to step way, way back into when did you realize you wanted to be a writer, Kit?
Oh, gosh. I've wanted to be a writer since I was even like in grade school. I remember I used to my parents still kid me about this. I even like made up my own newspaper when I was a kid. I even remember it was called News Teller Newspaper.
That's a good name.
Yep, News Teller. And I would write up, you know, I don't remember what the burning news items I was writing about, probably the bunnies in our yard or something like that. But,
the chaos of creation in the backyard.
Exactly. Chaos of creation, which, you know, which I'm in right now and I still love. But yeah, I've always loved writing and you know, I would write scripts, you know, for puppet shows and things like that. I mean, I just always loved it. And then, you know, as time went on, I mean, I just loved, you know, writing. You know, English was always my favorite subject. And I think I remember learning that. Oh, yeah. All right. And I remember learning what words, you know, what writing could do to affect people. When I was a senior in high school, I was the editor of the school paper. And I had written an editorial, or actually not an editorial, it was a concert review. And it was the first time I saw Paul McCartney live in 89. And it was called the Rosemont Horizon in Rosemont, Illinois, where, very close where Best for Beatles Fans is held today. And of course, I was so excited to see him live, as you can imagine. And I wrote this review of the concert and not only about the concert itself, but talking about, you know, what it was like to see a Beatle live, you know. And after that was published, a teacher, one day, you know, I was going to class and walking to class, and this teacher came along who I really didn't have for classes and said, you know, pulled me aside, said, can I talk to you for a minute? And I thought, uh-oh, what did I do? And he pulled me aside and he said, I read that piece that you wrote. And he said, I just had to tell you, it brought me back to when I was back in 1964, when I was a fan and I was a teenager. And he said, I just loved it. And he said, you brought me back to my youth. And I can't tell you how much I enjoyed that piece. And for the first time, it was kind of like, oh, you know, something I wrote affected, you know, somebody and really moved them in some way. And, you know, that made me think, huh, you know, I wonder if somehow I could do this for a living. But I then ended up, I did major in communications in college, but then I kind of went on a detour. I thought I'd teach writing for a while. But then when I finished my doctorate in instructional technology, I decided to take a break and decide whether I wanted to pursue academia permanently. And I started keeping a blog and was writing about music, which has always been kind of my first love. It's always been the background. I'd been writing for, you know, different music publications just for fun. And long story short, I ended up finding out about this site called Blog Critics, which is still around, and thought, you know, just for fun, maybe I'll apply for a job there, you know, writing about music. So I did, got the job, and that gradually led to the Michael Jackson book, you know, that I wrote an article on there about Michael Jackson. And Robert Rodriguez, who I'd already known anyway, we all know him, you know, he's the head of Something About the Beatles podcast. He's written a number of Beatles books, recommended me for this series FAQ. They were looking for someone to write about Michael Jackson, and I'd written this piece about him, and they said, you know, hey, why don't you audition for this? So it was kind of like a one thing led to another. You know, then I left Blog Critics, went to Something Else Reviews, started writing the Deep Beatles column, which I'd always wanted to do. wanted to write a Beatles column, and they let me go to it. And so I did that. And then that gradually led to other opportunities. So while I still kind of have one foot in academia, you know, that I do, you know, my presentations, I still write articles, I present at academic conferences, I'm able to combine it with my hobby, which I never thought I'd be able to do. I mean, I, you know, be able to make it my job.
And you get to sit in your backyard and do work. That's the best.
And exactly, I get to sit in my backyard and do work. I mean, I got,
you may know, have to worry about Ken Womack with his bunny hat running through.
Exactly. I mean, really. So it's just weird, you know. Life, that's what I've learned, you know, life takes twists and turns, you know, you think you're on track to do one thing, and then life throws these curveballs at you, and you end up doing other things. So really, I had no intention, never thought that my interest in music would be my career. I thought this was just going to be a hobby, and look what happened.
Yeah. So moving on to the next question, what was your first Beatles book that you ever read?
Now, okay, this is going to be a little controversial, but I have an explanation. It was a Jeffrey Giuliano book. Okay. Now,
that's a swear word.
Yes. Now, it was a book, it was a non-controversial book. First of all, I had no idea who he was at the time. I was probably around your age when I got it. Maybe 14, 15 when I got it. And it was called, I looked it up last night, because I was trying to remember the name of it. It was called, I think, Beatles, A Celebration. And it was mainly about memorabilia. So it was not really a controversial book.
Okay.
And I loved looking at the memorabilia. I remember this. I would sit and look at all the, you know, there were some, I mean, I will say this. It was a great book for that. I mean, there was some, I mean, he must have had a really good memorabilia collection. Because I remember seeing pictures of, like, the Flip Your Wig game and, you know, stuff like that. And it was just basically a general background about the Beatles story. I mean, I don't remember it being, like, super controversial. And it came out in about 86, from what I could tell. I was looking up the precise publication date. So yes, it was a Jeffrey Giuliano book. I didn't know who he was at the time, but it was not one of the, like, really, you know, shall we say, or yeah, yes. Yeah, let's put it that way.
I know I'm banned for saying that name on certain podcasts.
So I wanted to say that, but a little explanation.
Yeah.
And it was a long time ago. And I moved on to other people.
Good. You found your way.
I found my way.
You looked for your left and right, and you never closed in here. Yeah.
Right. You got it.
Yeah.
But the pictures were great. The pictures were real. They were good. The
good
pictures. Yeah, great memorabilia pictures.
So moving on, we kind of already discussed that. How did you get your gig at Beatle Fan?
Well, this was an interesting story. This was like in 90. I'm trying to think. Probably it was around 95, something like that. I was in grad school at the time, and the internet, I know this is, you know, I'm really dating myself here, so bear with me, Hudson. The internet was, you know, kind of new. You know, like, I had not encountered email or anything until about that time, because a lot of schools, like when I was in college, we didn't have email. We barely had the internet then. I mean, this
was
from
dial-up.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this was like old school, you know, 90 to 94. I was in college, And yeah, we didn't have you know, email, and really the only internet that anything close to it at my school, I was at a small school, was like at the library. There were certain databases you could access, you know, but that was about it. I mean, it was pretty basic. I mean, there was a friend of mine who was at University of Illinois at Champaign, and they were kind of ahead of the curve on email. And she would say to me, you know, hey, we could communicate via electronic mail. I mean, that's what it was called then. And I'd be like, what's that? You know, I mean, that's how basic it was. When I got to, when I was working on my master's degree at DePaul University, they finally said to all of us, you have to have email. And they gave us software. Where we could, you know, like a whole package with Netscape. That was the browser, and it was dial-up. You're right. I mean, it was really basic. So I was learning about all this stuff, and I was pretty fascinated by it. I mean, I've always been kind of fascinated by computer stuff. So around 95, Bill King, the editor of Beetle Fan, put out a call for people to apply. To start to write a column for Beetle Fan about Beetle sites on the internet. This was brand new. I mean, you know, sites were just starting to turn up on the internet. Now, when I say, and this is one thing I've really loved about doing this job all these years later, because I've really gotten a front seat to see how they've developed all these years, because the first Beetle sites were so basic. I mean, because it was dial-up. You couldn't have big-time graphics. No. I mean, you know.
You'd have, like, the Driving Rain cover.
Yeah, exactly. It was kind of like that. I mean, you know, it was, I mean, these were the days where you would load up a site and you'd go to your, you know, go to the kitchen, make a sandwich, and then come back and hope the site had loaded up. I mean, it was like that, you know. So a lot of it was just text and that kind of thing. So so this was a new kind of thing. So so Bill was looking for a columnist to, this was going to be their beat, you know, was to keep track of the sites. So I thought, I was just starting to get into this whole world. And so I'm like, you know, I wanted to, because I'd been a subscriber Beetle Fan for a while, and I really wanted to be a writer. And I thought, this is my way in. And yeah. So I'm like, I can do this. So I applied. And so I think maybe a couple of other people, you know, auditioned. And I won, and I got the job. And so I've been writing ever since, all these years later. And as I said, it's been so cool to see how these sites have developed. Steve Mirannucci's new site was one of the first I ever reviewed. And it was Abbey Road. I think it was called Abbey Road New Site, something like that. And it was all text. But that was one of the first I ever reviewed, and it was one of the best of its time, because it was all news, and, you know, that's where you got it back then.
Which is crazy to imagine. It really is.
Yep, and of course, no social media. I mean, that was unheard of. And really, George Harrison's site in 2001, when the All Things Must Pass, anniversary edition came out, that, and you can still find it, I think, on the Wayback Machine, that was a gigantic leap forward technologically. I mean, they really put a lot of work into that site with animation, flash animation and everything. I mean, that was a gigantic leap forward. And all the other Beatles sites really then, like, you know, Paul's and Ringo's, they started putting way more work into their sites after that, because that was like, I remember reviewing that and saying, you know, wow, you know, this is amazing. You know, this is like the future, you know.
There's a 480p pixel picture.
Yeah. On there. I mean, you know, and I mean, probably today it wouldn't look like anything special, but in 2001, yeah, I mean, that was a big deal. So that's how I ended up. And now I write other stuff too, for Beetle Fan. But that's how I started.
Yeah. And that's crazy. Mm-hmm. What's your favorite Beatles book now?
Oh, gosh. I think I have to go with the classic Mark Lewisohn Beatles recording sessions. I refer to that book all the time. When I wrote my my book, you know, all my columns, which became Songs We Were Singing, I mean, that book is so dog-eared. I mean, I refer to it all the time. I mean, I love many of his other books, too. But that's the one, that's like my Bible when it comes to research. It's just, and I know he has said that, you know, he made some mistakes in it and all, but it's still, to me, the go-to. And he's written so many other wonder, Tune In, of course, and can't wait for his other two, whenever they arrive. But I just, that one to me was such, like, I mean, when I got that book back in, oh gosh, I probably was maybe a senior in high school or something when I first got that book. That was just, I would pore over that. And I just, to this day, I you know, it's my go-to. I love it.
Yeah, I haven't read that book yet, but that's on my go list. I was surprised when I heard Lewisohn. I was surprised you didn't say Tune In.
That has
become most people's Bible.
You know, and that's wonderful too.
I mean, it
really is. But for like the complete, because that's for a certain time period, of
right.
course. And it's wonderful, no question. But for just pure research, I mean, I've got to give it to recording sessions because, as I said, my copy is dog-eared. I mean, it is beaten up because I've used it so much over the years. So, like, if I had one Beatle book, like, if you know, the whole, if you were on a deserted island and you could only take one book with you, that'd be the one for me. Absolutely. Yeah.
Thankfully, Eight Arms to Hold You is a PDF.
Yes, exactly. That'd be tough.
A $200 book.
Yep.
Very dog.
Thank God I bought that book years ago before it went up, because ouch.
So now I'm gonna actually divide this into two questions.
Okay.
This is the hard question, I think.
Uh-oh.
Who is your favorite Beatle when it comes to the group?
Oh, man. It's really tough, but I guess I'd have to go with Paul by a very slight, slight margin. I guess I've always been kind of a Paul person because, you know, he just, for his versatility. You know, he really, I mean, George and John have great versatility too, but, you know, he just has such, I mean, he can do it all. I mean, he's got that wonderful, you know, hard rock kind of voice, but of course he can also do ballads. Sergeant Pepper, you know, was basically his concept. The Abbey Road medley, was, you know, a great deal of it his concept. I just tend to be drawn a bit more to him. I mean, not to put down George or John at all, because I love their stuff too. Don't get me wrong. But I guess and in his solo career too, for versatility, I guess I'd have to go with Paul. But that's a tough one.
I'm gonna now be a pain. Your answer is probably going to be the same. Just for the solo years that all four of them were alive, who was your favorite?
Oh, man. I guess, again, I'd have to go with Paul, but boy, slightly over George.
Just thank you.
Slightly.
Thank you.
I mean, because, boy, that's close. Because George, man. All Things Must Pass. I mean, that's been an album that's meant so much to me, you know, and it's, that's so hard. And George did so many great albums too. I just, you know, I wish he had done more, you know, But we'll be talking about one of his albums in a little while. But yeah, I would say Paul by just a very slight margin.
Yes. So we've kind of discussed a little bit about the songs we were singing. Do you want to kind of elaborate how it came about with all
sure.
the columns?
Like sure. The- well, you know, I really what I was doing was, you know, I wanted to write, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to write about the Beatles, because let's face it, a lot has been written about them. A lot. And so I thought, what can I add to the conversation? And I was trying to figure out what my niche would be. And so I then thought, well, what about talking about the songs that are the lesser known, as I call them, not the unknown, because some people have said to me along the way, well, there are no lesser known tracks. Well, I argue there are, that they're the ones that, you know, they weren't the big hits. You know, they're the ones that they're the album tracks, the B-sides, some of the songs they never perform live. And sure, to the hardcore fan, maybe they're not, quotes, lesser known. But I feel like there are some songs that tend to be, you know, kind of dismissed, even in some Beatle books, some other Beatle books that I've read.
I will agree with that.
Yeah, that they tend to be just kind of tossed off in a couple of sentences. And that I feel they deserve more attention. And they tend to be kind of, you know, dismissed in terms of describing what, you know, where they fit into the Beatles' artistic development. You know, they tend to be written off as filler or something. So that's the challenge that I presented myself. And so that's became the concept for Deep Beatles, you know, where I would argue some of these tracks and even, you know, argued like Mr. Moonlight, which everybody loves to, you know, put down. Okay, I thought, all right, I'm going to argue my case of, you know, why should we, what is there that we can defend about Mr. Moonlight? You know, things like that. So that became my column. And so I wrote so many of these that I then thought, you know what? I think I've got a book here. and also, when I was at Blog Critics, which I mentioned earlier, I wrote a ton of Beatles stuff about there too, and solo stuff. And a lot of that material you can no longer find on Blog Critics because they've since changed ownership and they purged a lot of the really old stuff off there. So now the only place you can find my stuff I wrote on Blog Critics is in that book. It's in that book. So, yep. So that's it. You know, it's no longer on the internet. You can only find it there. And there's a lot there that I wrote. Which we'll talk a little bit about in just a few minutes. But, so I thought, I think I've got a book. And so that's what I did. And I also wrote an exclusive chapter where I talk about Ringo and underrated drumming performances. Because we all, you know, we all hear about the great, you know, the drum solo we had in the end and that kind of stuff and all that. I mean, yes, and wonderful. We love hearing that. But I also write about some other performances that I think he doesn't get enough credit for because they might be a little more subtle, you know. So it was really fun, you know, getting the material together for this book and to, you know, just gather it all together to say, you know, these are the songs we were singing.
Sorry.
Oh, no problem. That gave me time to get my book out here, so no worries. It gave me a little time to pull the book out, so no worries at all.
Awesome. So, I want to move on to the song discussions.
All right.
So I don't think we're going to have time to discuss all of them that I pulled out. But first of all, let's start with Don't Bother Me.
Okay, absolutely.
Why did this scream overlooked to you?
Well, you know, people tend to, including George, by the way, you know, I found an interview with him where he said, oh, you know, this was just kind of a, you know, this was his first. Yeah, I think he just kind of wrote it off because, oh, this was his first attempt. And he just sort of wrote it off as, you know, yeah, this was my first song that I got on. It wasn't that great. And, you know, move on. Well, okay. Yes, and I'm not saying it was While My Guitar Gently Weeps. I mean, you know, it wasn't. But I think it does have, it is significant, first of all, because, yes, it is the first George Harrison composition that made it onto a record. But I think it also has some, it portends some other elements that were on Beatles records. First of all, it has that kind of Latin element to it, and that percussion. And this is something that they were fascinated with since their Hamburg days, and would continue doing. I mean, like, you know, even back when, like, Besame Mucho. I mean, even, you know, before that, or P.S. I Love You. You know, they used it. They would continue to do it on And I Love Her, I Feel Fine. So this was not their first, brush with Latin, Latin rhythms. But also, you know, this also would portend, you know, George's continuing fascination with integrating world music with rock. As we all know, he would continue doing that, particularly with Eastern music. But he, you know, this is sort of his first taste of that, with that. So, and obviously he would even go further into that in his solo work. So you see, you know, in just this composition, just that first little taste of that. Also, you see the lyrics in this. Now, you can say, you know, oh, they're very pessimistic and all. Well, and yes, they are. But they're also kind of characteristic of what became George's songwriting. They're biting, you know, certainly. You know, he's talking about, I think this was kind of a, you know, he never was that comfortable with fame. You know, we know that. You know, he certainly got tired of being, you know, the mob scenes of Beatlemania. You know, and certainly this song kind of alludes to that. I think this is a clue of where he was going to go in some of his songwriting. It wasn't going to be all, you know, She Loves You and, you know, typical just love song material. This was very personal, and yes, a bit more pessimistic. You know, he would explore some kind of darker themes and a little bit of humorous wordplay and, you know, Only a Northern Song, Taxman, Piggies, in his solo stuff, this song, Sue Me, Sue You Blues, Devil's Radio. I mean, you know, so while this may not have the sophistication of some of those other songs, this is the first inkling we see of it in Don't Bother Me. So, you know, so I think while you can say, well, this doesn't rise to the level of some of his later compositions, this is a first, very important first step for George in terms of his lyricism and also that first kind of experimentation with, you know, world rhythms, world music rhythms. So I felt it was important to note that.
I'll agree with that. It's probably my favorite song on with the Beatles.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Now, I don't say this a lot, but I'm not as big of a fan as of Paul's Beatle material as I am of his solo career.
Interesting.
That is
why is that?
I don't love Granny music, and I feel like he got more sophisticated in his solo career.
Yeah, I mean, he did certainly get, like, on Ram and all, more experimental. That's true.
Yeah. I'll agree with that, but... Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that pick.
Mm-hmm.
Now, moving on to this song. This may be the most overlooked Beatles song, Run for Your Life.
Yep. This, now, you know, is interesting. When I decided to write about this, I thought, wonder if I'm going to get a lot of backlash for this, because this song has become, you know, controversial, shall we say, in recent years. And yes, the lyrics are a bit jarring today, although, of course, you know, some people don't know that I'd rather see you dead, little girl, than to be with another man. That was actually a line from an Elvis song.
If Elvis had sung that, it would have been given away, which I don't understand.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. So I mean, it was from Baby, Let's Play House. So you know, John didn't write that line, a station in Ottawa banned the song in 1992 for the lyrics. Yes, certainly. And Paul later called it, I think it was when he was interviewed in the book many years from now, he called it a pretty macho song. Yes, you know, the lyrics didn't age well. Let's put it that way. And yes, as a woman, the lyrics make me cringe a bit. But the song itself, actually, I mean, there are a lot of great things to say about it. The harmonies on this are excellent. You know, those patented tight harmonies that the Beatles were just so good at. You know, particularly in the lines, you know, describing, you know, about the girl should run and hide to avoid the narrator's wrath. John's lead on this is lead vocal is also
it's up with him. It's Only Love is one of his best vocal performances.
Mm-hmm. Yep, but he really, you know, uses his voice so well on this, like the slight roughness of his voice on certain lines, you know, adds to kind of the sinister, you know, connotations of the words, you know. I mean, you know, how just, you know, blending in just an ominous tone about how he can't spend the rest of his life forcing, you know, his lover to obey his wishes, and that line, you know, and I mean every word I say. Yeah, you believe it. Yeah. Absolutely. The percussion on this is excellent, the tambourine weaving in and out, you know, taking the place of a harder drum beat, I think works extremely well. And then the returning to the, you know, at the end of the opening verse and the final return to the chorus, and then the one kind of sort of half scatting as the song fades out, and just sort of the whole arrangement itself, that it's sort of contradictory that here you get these kind of, you know, these sinister, you know, dark sounding lyrics, and yet the tune itself is so bouncy. You know, that if you know, weren't listening closely, you know, you'd be kind of tapping your foot and, you know, snapping
same
along.
Same with girls' school.
Yeah, exactly. But then you listen to the lyrics and it's, you know, whoa. So it's a very intriguing song, and that it's actually, you know, very well arranged. The harmonies are just, you know, those great tight Beatles harmonies, great lead vocal performance, very effective from John. You know, are the lyrics a bit problematic? Sure. You know, of course they are. But the song itself really shouldn't be overlooked because of that. You know, I mean, if you can get past the lyrics, it's actually, I think, a great song. And really shouldn't be just swept under the carpet because of the problematic lyrics.
Right. And Yeah, so the next song I want to talk about is actually McCartney's solo song, Little Willow.
Oh, yes.
Written about, I think her name was Maureen Starkey. Correct me if I'm wrong. Okay.
Yes.
Ringo's first wife.
Yes, Maureen Cox, her maiden name, and Maureen Starkey, yes. Yeah, she had passed during the recording of the Flaming Pie album, and apparently Paul and Linda had remained very close to her and the whole family, and were very, were quite affected when she died. And so Paul wrote this haunting, beautiful song for her. Although it's interesting when you listen to it now, obviously not long after Flaming Pie came out, Linda passed. And so you tend to listen to this song now and almost associate it with Linda as much as Maureen, even though it wasn't written for Linda. This is just a great example of, Paul McCartney at his best in terms of, writing a beautiful melody, simple, and, keeping it simple, and just such touching lyrics. Jeff Lynne produced this and did really such a just had such a light touch on this, just as he should have. And which he isn't always known for doing, but he kept it light, but he kept it light just as he should have. Paul played most of the instruments on this track, bass guitar, acoustic guitar, Spanish, he really kept it mainly acoustic. And Jeff Emmerich was the engineer on this, which is kind of a nice Beatlesque touch. And obviously Paul's voice is foremost in the mix, and the lyrics are just so touching. It's about coping with, difficult circumstances, meeting life's challenges and dealing with the fact that, we don't have control over everything. Right. And that, and I think it's beautiful that not only is he addressing Maureen, but he's addressing her family, those that are left behind after a loved one is gone, and that only time will heal their wounds. I mean, who can't relate to this? And it's just, but that love will, kind of an all you need is love message in a way that love will heal all wounds. It's I think one of his best solo songs. I mean, I love Flaming Pie, the album, but this is one of the standout tracks from it, and I really wanted to highlight that when I wrote about it. Just gorgeous.
Interestingly enough, I think I read that or heard it on a podcast that people think that Paul was writing that for himself a little bit too in advance because he knew Linda was gonna die very soon.
Yeah, you can, and I can see that argument because it is a very kind of consoling song that, he is sort of writing about that about, coping with life challenges and, as I said, accepting that you can't control everything. It is just so stunning, and as I said, I think should go up there with some of his great, great compositions.
I will agree with that. So moving on to a Ringo song, Weight of the World. This should have been a number one. Let's just get that out of the way.
I'll tell you, and people who have listened to some of my interviews and listened to me on Talk More Talk will know I am a huge defender of this song and a huge advocate of the song. You are right. This should have been a much bigger hit than it was. I remember when this first came out, and I instantly loved it. And it is a mystery. I guess it was because, the album, Ringo was signed, this was supposed to be his comeback. And unfortunately, Ringo was signed to a small label. And I think the label just couldn't afford a big, you know, push for this single and this album, because this should have been a much bigger hit and a much bigger success than it was. Because I think this single is right up there with some of his best, you know, with Photograph, It Don't Come Easy. This was just, I think he had all the makings of a hit. He was in terrific voice, a great producer, Don was. I'm a big fan of his and his group Was Not Was from the 80s. The lyrics, you know, maybe the lyrics were a little too serious for some people. I don't know. I thought they were beautiful and were kind of very apt for what Ringo was going through, which was, you know, he was just coming out of a decade where he was going through rehab and, you know, very difficult time. And, you know, the lyrics of this have to do with, you know, letting go of your past and then letting go of your burdens to move on to the future. I mean, you know, kind of a serious subject, but ultimately a positive message. I mean, what's wrong with that? The arrangement was perfect. I mean, it really was a terrific single, and really should have been the comeback hit that Ringo deserved. And I think it just suffered from a lack of promotion. I really do.
Yes. So now I want to move on. This will be my last question.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, time is not very nice sometimes.
Yes.
I want to just talk about the 2009 remasters. Coming from those 87 mixes, and I'm a vinyl person, so I don't own any of those 87 mixes, but let's just say I have heard very bad things.
I'll tell you. As someone who experienced this whole thing, the 87 CDs sounded like they were remastered in a tin can. I mean, they were awful. They were all we had at the time. It was, you know, they were just, sounded like they were done in a rush. And to be fair, the technology wasn't there in 1987 that we have now. So, I mean, I guess you have to be somewhat fair, but, there was a lot of controversy about some of them were in mono, some of them weren't. They, as I said, they were kind of done in a rush. The source tapes, were not great quality. I mean, it really, and at Beatle Fan at the time, boy, the letters that people sent in saying the bass channels were switched. And I mean, it was a disaster. And it took way too long for the 2009 remasters to come out. And I remember when I saw the Cirque du Soleil show Love back in 2006. And they, of course, had that album that that Giles and George Martin took part in remixing. And I mean, that was a one-off thing. They were almost like mashups and the whole thing, but remastering was involved in that. And I remember sitting in that theater, and the theater, of course, did have incredible speakers. And so, I mean, it was a different kind of listening situation, but I remember sitting there thinking, my God, this is what the music should sound like, because we were still stuck with those 87 mixes. And to hear that, you just thought, God, when are they ever going to remaster that catalog? Because this is what it should sound like. I mean, I heard sounds, some vocals and all that I'd never noticed before. And so finally, in 2009, they gave us what we had hoped for. And you'll read in my book, I did articles at the time on that and did some A-B comparisons. And the comparisons were incredible. Particularly on like Tomorrow Never Knows. I remember just being blown away. I mean, there was just no contest. I mean, the 2009 remasters, I mean, just cleaned up all the muddiness of the 1987. I mean, clarified so much. You know, it's just a shame we had to wait that long. I mean, way too long. And yes, part of it was the technology wasn't there. I don't know. I think it was probably more than that. But it was. I'll tell you, Hudson. When those came out, I mean, fans were just like, we were just stupid excited because we were stuck with those awful originals for way too long. So the excitement was off the charts.
So, Kit, I want to thank you for coming on the show again.
Oh, thank you. This was so much fun. I always love coming on.
And you'll be back to the Best Solo Beatles podcast.
Hey, these are both great.
Yes, they are. You can email me at iknowinopodcast@gmail.com. I do want to just quickly mention that my episode with Martin Quibell of Pods Like Us is up, and I did link that in the description, and I will be appearing on Paul or Nothing soon. So I want to thank you all for listening, and peace and love.